I understand that there'll be some people in the audience who don't know very much about Jung, so I hope that the professionals will forgive me if I go through it, the whole idea just from the beginning. I've been sitting there thinking about how to present this material, and I was reminded of a story about the devil and his friend who were walking down a street, and ahead of them they saw a man who found something on the sidewalk that excited him. He was very excited about it, and the devil's friend said to the devil, "What's he found that he's so pleased with?" And the devil said, "Oh, he's found the truth." And the devil's friend said, "Well, isn't that bad for your business?" And the devil said, "Oh no, I'm going to help him organize it." So that's what I'm going to try and do. I'm going to try and organize this aspect of Jung. So just for the sake of people who are not familiar with Jung, we divide, how do I make this? Oh, this side. We divide the psyche into these different levels. The tip of this iceberg is consciousness, that we call the ego. This is what's called the repression barrier. And below that is all the material that all the personalistic writers like Freud and Klein and Kohut all write about. Repress unconscious material below the repression barrier. And then the specific contribution of Jung is this level, which is the level of the autonomous psyche, or the transpersonal level of the unconscious. And that's the source of spiritual experience or religious experience, according to Jung. This is a controversial idea, as you'll see, because it contradicts some notions, traditional theistic ideas about the source of spiritual experience. But I'll go into that a little bit later. So what this looks like, just diagrammatically, is if you can imagine each of these little pyramid forms is a human being on the planet, so there are 7 billion of them on the planet. Each of us, by virtue of being human, participates in this deep level of the psyche. We all have access to that level. And imagery from this level, which is the mythopoetic level of the psyche, it's like the level from which religious experience and all the religious traditions arise. It's common to all of us. This is the model. So the story briefly of the term numinous. The term numinous comes from the Latin numen, N-U-M-E-N, which means a divinity. And the idea was brought into common use in 1917 by Rudolf Otto, who was a Lutheran theologian. And he was concerned in his day that religion had degenerated into just moral preaching, and that people had lost touch with the original source of the traditions, which was the sense of direct contact with the holy. So his book, Das Heilige, I didn't write it down here, the original work in German, Das Heilige, was translated into English as the idea of the holy. It simply means the holy. And it's been such an important book that it's actually been in print for now almost 100 years. Still an English translation, the idea of the holy, still worth reading. But he used this term to describe experiences that, there are many experiences of this particular quality that he's trying to get at. The common ones are the biblical experiences, such as Saul on the road to Damascus, on his way to persecute Jesus' followers, and he sees a blinding light and hears Jesus' voice saying, "Why do you persecute me?" Or Moses at the burning bush, tending his father-in-law's sheep in the desert, and hears the voice of God from the bush telling him to go to Egypt and tell the Pharaoh to free the people. That's the kind of experience that Otto was talking about when he coined the term numinous. And he said these are direct experiences of the holy, and these are the sources, or Muhammad, of course, in Islam, as it were, taking dictation from the angel Gabriel writing the Quran. So Otto says these are the sources of our religious traditions, direct experience of the sacred or the holy. Now, another example here is Job talking to God, appearing to him out of a whirlwind. So the Bible is full of these things, these kind of experiences. For Otto, these are all experiences of the traditional theistic idea of God. For Jung, these are the important difference is that all these experiences are experiences of the transpersonal level of the psyche. And this is where he's at variance with traditional theologians. I'll come back to that. Now, the way you can recognize these experiences is because they have a particular emotional quality. They affect people in a particular way. He's described them as mysterious, tremendous, and fascinating. He used Latin terms. He said they are experiences of the mysterium, tremendum, et fascinans. He was really a 19th century scholar when Latin was still de rigueur in academic writing. But the idea is that you feel that you're in touch with something that's completely out of your ordinary everyday experience, completely other, completely inexplicable, often producing an experience of awe or dread or uncanniness, something like that. So powerful, if you can imagine talking to the voice of God coming out of a burning bush or something, but you have no idea what you're in touch with and you feel completely emotionally overwhelmed. Sometimes, as I've said here, a sensation of blessing. Sometimes these experiences produce a religious conversion and so on. And Otto was concerned that we had lost touch, the tradition had lost touch with this kind of quality of experience. And what happened is that when Jung gave the Terry lectures, which are held every 4 years or so at Yale University on the psychology of religion, he realized that he was hearing experiences with this kind of emotional, intense emotional quality in the consulting room, by people who were not, you know, among the saints or mystics of the tradition, or special people in any kind of traditional religious sense. There were people that he was seeing in analysis or therapy, and they were having experiences with this quality. And the important point from Jung's point of view is not the content of the experience. It doesn't have to be specifically Judeo-Christian in its content. In fact, it very often isn't. You can have mythological imagery from any religious tradition can appear in the dreams or fantasies or visionary experiences of perfectly ordinary people. And what matters, as I said here, is the emotional quality of the experience, not the content. So when you have an experience that's awesome, mysterious, fascinating, that for Jung would qualify as a numinous experience. It wouldn't qualify as such in the eyes of many Judeo-Christian theologians, if it didn't have a specific traditional content. This is a major difference. For Otto, these are experiences of the Christian God. For Jung, they're experiences of the objective psyche, the collective unconscious or the autonomous psyche. And you'll remember that he has the notion that there is a self written in the English literature with a capital S. An image of the divine, what he calls an imago Dei, an image of the divine in the psyche, which is a priori. What that means is it's not the result of experience. When you're born, it's simply present. And it can take a wide variety of forms. It doesn't have to be confined to one of the traditional images. So if you were in a Christian tradition, then that image would be projected onto Jesus Christ. And if you were in South America, it might be projected onto Quetzalcoatl or some other figure. Or in Asia, it might be projected onto Guan Yin or any of the Hindu deities. For Jung, all these deities represent carriers. They have the capacity to carry the projection of the self. So there isn't one specific God image to Jung. This is another one of the major differences between this depth psychological approach to spirituality and traditional theistic approaches. And this is very, very important. The fact that contact with the self, with the transpersonal self, and in the English literature we can distinguish between the self with a capital S and the lowercase s. So the lowercase s self would be the personal self, yourself, myself, the everyday empirical human being. This is something that's quite different. It's an image of the divine in the psyche. it manifests itself in ways that are completely different than the traditions will tell you. Now, the importance of this for Jung is that these experiences have a healing effect. This is from a letter where he says that my main interest is the approach to the numinous, and the approach to the numinous is the real therapy. That's an extraordinarily powerful statement. Most theorists have a theory of cure, theory about what's really helpful in psychotherapy. And in a sense, this is Jung's theory of cure, that once you have an experience with this kind of quality, it has a beneficial healing effect. And what I want to do this evening is to describe a variety of these non-traditional forms of numinous experience and explain the effect that they have on the personality. They tend to occur when people are in a crisis. They may erupt at any time in a person's life. But you know, when you're distressed and grieving or greatly stressed in your life, it's as if the veil between this consciousness and the other side, as it were, the larger consciousness, gets a little thinner, and these kind of experiences are quite likely to erupt. There, as I've said here, the intense emotional power of the experience seems to be responsible for its beneficial effect. I will give some examples of this. This is just, last night I was talking at William James College to a group of psychologists who practice a form of psychology that would have horrified William James, but that's beside the point. He was very, very interested. His book on the varieties of religious experience is another discussion of this kind of experience and the importance of them. And he had different criteria than Otto, which I think are also quite useful, so I mentioned them here. These are James's criteria. The experience is ineffable, meaning it's hard to put into words. Secondly, it's noetic. It gives you knowledge or information that you didn't know about before. The experience is transient. Usually you have one of these experiences and it's quite brief, lasting perhaps the length of a dream or a visionary experience, but not very long. And the last one in his mind is that you're passive. You can't make these things come and go. You can prepare for them with intensive spiritual practice, but you can meditate or pray till you're blue in the face and nothing may happen, or they may just arise spontaneously. That's what we mean by saying that this level of the psyche is autonomous. It does what it wants. And this is just a list of all the different modalities. I'll talk about some of them. The dream is a common modality, but I think what I want to talk, maybe I'll focus tonight on the issue of waking visions. What I mean by a visionary experience is an experience which is like a dream, except that the subject is awake. These experiences are not uncommon, but they are uncommonly reported because people are afraid that if I talk about having had a vision or something, you will think I'm either crazy or inflated or hysterical or something. So they're not commonly reported, but they are quite common. Synchronistic events, I guess everybody's here is familiar with that notion. And you can experience the numinous in the natural world. There's a whole tradition of nature mysticism in all our religious traditions, people who experience the divine in nature, who have powerful numinous experiences of the natural world. They're usually accused of being pantheists and so on. And some people experience this in the body. So here's an example of a numinous dream. And this dream is a good example of a sort of Jungian dictum, which is that you cannot Christianize the unconscious. In other words, this deep level of the unconscious can produce imagery from any religious tradition. It may not be the tradition that you were raised in. So you may have been raised a Congregationalist or something, from this deep level of the psyche, you may have an experience of a Hindu god or goddess or an Egyptian deity that you have absolutely no knowledge of. But just by virtue of being human, imagery from any religious tradition or any mythological tradition might arise. So this is an image of a man who was in his late 50s who has been a Roman Catholic priest all his life. And at the time, he had this dream. He was losing his faith. He was losing faith in the church. He was in a rather desperate state because he was afraid that he'd spent his whole life teaching and preaching, you know, as he said, hatching, matching, and dismatching. That suddenly the whole thing had lost meaning for him. It was as if it was as if no longer had any. Somehow he began to doubt the whole thing. He was losing faith, and it was causing considerable distress. So he has a dream in which this figure appears to him. Now this, the actual figure itself, is known as the Venus of Willendorf. It's the oldest pagan goddess figure that we know of, from old Europe, probably 10 or 15,000 years ago. And these figures were used as traveling altars. You'll notice that she has no feet. They were just taken around and stuck in the sand by goddess-worshipping cultures. So this is way before the advent of the Western monotheistic traditions. The actual figure itself is quite short. But in his dream, she's huge in the sky above him. A gigantic goddess figure from pagan Europe. And what's happening is he holds a communion cup in his hand, he lifts it up, and milk starts to flow from the breast of the goddess into the communion cup. And he says to me, in the dream I realized I was in the presence of something intensely holy. And this was an extremely powerful, numinous experience. He knew nothing about this figure. This is what James means by the noetic aspect. It's telling him, it's kind of what I would call a teaching dream. First of all, emotionally it was very powerful. It was mysterious, tremendous, fascinating. You can imagine empathically how this must have felt for him. He was completely awestruck by this figure and her milk. And it was telling him that really what is sacred to him is the feminine aspects of the divine. Really, he's a devotee of the goddess. He may have been worshipping a male sky god all his life, but this is his real spirituality is something else. And the dream was telling him that, I think. That's one of the values of this kind of experience, that you develop an individual spirituality that's all your own. This would not be regarded as a collective god image, obviously. There are collective god images like Jesus Christ, or just the symbol of the cross, which would be sacred to many, many people. But a figure like this is highly individual. It would only have a numinous quality to this man. So he has now a copy of this figure on his own altar. So this would be described in the Jungian tradition as a personal symbol rather than a collective symbol. But it's a true symbol in the sense that it acts as a bridge from the unconscious from the deep unconscious into consciousness, putting him in touch with that level and putting him in touch with the energetic quality of that level, which is so important to him. How do I make this go away? Okay. These experiences are produce imagery that is completely unknown. Oh, it's come back. It's had a rebirth experience. Where is Deborah? Could you help me switch it off, please?
Oh, okay. I think you can just
unplug it or something.
I don't want to unplug it.
Oh, okay.
I'm afraid then we'll lose it forever. You just want this to shut.
Oh, just shut it down. Shall we do that?
Hold on.
Yeah.
About this.
Thanks. Thank heaven you're here.
I don't know about that. Why don't we do this?
What did you do?
Put it to sleep.
Well, I tried that. It woke up again. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I want to give you an example, a personal example, of how difficult sometimes it can be to interpret this kind of experience. And I said I'm going to focus on visionary experiences deliberately. So I want to tell you a visionary experience I had and how it was helpful to me personally at the time. Although at the time it was actually completely mysterious and I had no idea what it meant. So about 9 years ago, and the timing is important. I had an experience where I was lying in bed and I was wide awake. This was definitely not a dream. I was lying in bed, and suddenly a figure appeared next to my bed. A tall, grey figure. And it looked like it was carved out of stone, but it was obviously alive. And it looked down at me, and the second terrifying thing, apart from its initial appearance, was that it had three faces. It had a face looking down, and a face coming from either outside of its head. Okay. So I was terrified out of my wits. This certainly meets Otto's criteria, right? It's mysterious, tremendous, fascinating. Okay, it meets James's criteria. I didn't know the noetic meaning of it initially. Anyway, I did what all good Jungians are supposed to do. I went straight to the library and called several colleagues, saying, but I didn't think I was psychotic. We should, by the way, talk about, at some point, the difference between this and psychosis, because it's quite different than psychosis. This is what's called in the mythological literature a tricephalic god image. When I looked into it, I didn't know at the time, but it turns out that there are large numbers of gods and goddesses in many traditions who either have three gods, three heads, or three faces. So the Buddha is sometimes depicted that way. There's a Celtic god, Canunus, who was Serapis, a kind of a syncretic Greco-Egyptian god, was depicted that way. Hecate was depicted that way. There are lots of them. It's an archetypal quality of some deities. It's a Trinitarian image in a way. The idea seems to be that one face is looking at the present, one into and one into the future, something like that. So I didn't know what to make of it, but it was transient. Shortly after that, I became extremely ill and nearly died. Then I began to understand, I finally, having consulted with several colleagues about this figure, I decided it was actually a visit from Hermes to Mercury. Okay. Mercury is one of the deities from antiquity who was often depicted with three heads or three faces. So for various reasons, linking it with other material, I decided this was Mercury. The important thing about Hermes Mercury is that he was a herald figure. When the gods on Olympus wanted to convey information to mortals, they would send Hermes Mercury with the message. Mm-hmm. When I became ill, I realized that this was a messenger figure. That was really the archetype. And that he was looking backwards and forwards. And if you people who know alchemy will be able to amplify the figure in terms of the spirit of the unconscious. The spirit in the body, the spirit in matter, which I've actually had, because of my typology, I've had very little relation to the body. It's always been the dark continent. So this was like the sort of the phonic god of the somatic unconscious. That's how I finally thought of it. Anyway, I won't go into too much detail about that. But how does this meet Jung's criteria of a healing experience? Before the illness, it wasn't particularly healing, it was just baffling. Once I got the illness, I was able to say, well, something knew that this was going to happen. This was not random. I was forewarned about that. I was greatly relieved by the idea that the self, as it were, knew and foretold that this was going to happen. I found that, I don't like the idea that life is a tale told by the idiot. I prefer to think that there's some kind of background intelligence. In this case, we call it the self. And that knew about this. You know, there's something of a debate in the Jungian literature about whether significant illness is the result of the individuation process becoming blocked, so that the psyche has to express itself through an illness, or whether the illness itself is an integral aspect of the individuation process itself. You can find opinions on both sides. Anyway, for me, the illness was a major step. So that's an example of how the thing has a healing effect. Now, the point is that if I was to take this to a Judeo-Christian or Islamic theologian and say, what was this figure? They would not be sympathetic to the figure. They would say, I know that some people would say it was demonic. I mean, anything that's normal. I had a patient not long ago who had a dream in which Jesus appeared to her as an old woman, and her minister told her that this was a dream from the devil. Okay, but the figure in the dream was very numinous for her, and it all has obvious symbolic meanings in terms of the feminine aspect of the divine and so on. It's not, of course, it's just frankly silly. But some of them are very concrete. You know, I had enough, just while I'm loose associating to silly clergymen, I had one patient who had an eating disorder. She was bulimic, and she was told by her minister that she should eat less because the gates of paradise are narrow. So if you have the misfortune to have a minister like that, and you take an experience like this to that kind of person, it's dismissed as demonic. Whereas from the point of view of this paradigm, this Jungian paradigm, this is a message from your autonomous psyche that it knows that something important is going to happen. And it becomes a personal symbol of great emotional importance. I think what I'm going to do is focus a little bit more on visionary experiences. Because people write to me with visionary experiences. I have now quite a collection of them. This is an experience of a man who was in a very severe depression. He had the following experience. A huge thick curtain, these are his words, slowly came down and surrounded me. I was lifted up and stood on a high mountain peak with large rock outcroppings. I couldn't see over the edge. The space was at once open and contained. The mountain was ancient and felt volcanic. This is the very numinous part. Surrounding me, sitting among the rocks, were the forms of the hosts of heaven. I knew they had gathered there in order to meet me. They seemed to be expecting me and to delight in my presence. A soft white glow radiated around me, and I felt a deep warmth and sense of belonging. For that moment in time, I was heaven's agenda. This was a very brief, numinous experience. It meets all the criteria of both these theories that I've talked about, and it had an astonishingly restorative effect on this man, who had felt very alone and isolated, and all of a sudden he became heaven's agenda. It's a similar experience of being told that there is a transpersonal something or other watching over you, that no matter how much in despair you are, there is some other realm of existence which is aware of your existence. That's how these kind of experiences can be helpful. It doesn't matter what the content of the experience is. Here's another visionary experience. And this is the experience of a woman who'd been a nurse all her life. She was in therapy because she complained of what she called compassion fatigue. Am I making that noise? She was burnt out, essentially. She was the kind of person that felt that she could only be of value as a human being if she devoted herself completely to the service of other people. The service to other people was the ticket for being on the planet. Otherwise, she didn't deserve to be there. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the Enneagram. She was a classic two, the classic helper. She would stress herself terribly because she could never meet her own high standard. She never felt that she was doing enough. So she had exhausted herself. She had that reports the following experience. These are her words. Suddenly I was aware of a pinpoint of light at the foot of my bed. So this was another waking experience. And again, you heard light in the previous experience and light in this. Light is one of the commonest archetypal manifestations of the holy or the sacred. You find it in all the traditions, like the nimbus around the head of the Buddha. It's just an absolute archetypal symbol of the presence of the holy. So I'm aware of a pinpoint of light at the foot of the bed. I became alarmed. It expanded in size to about 6 inches, floating mysteriously in the dark. Here's Otto's criteria. This woman had never heard of Otto, I promise you, or Jung. She said, I was fearful and fascinated and awestruck. by the weird presence of something like this in my bedroom. So this immediately qualifies in terms of Otto's criteria. I was sure I was not dreaming. The oval of light spoke wordlessly and identified itself as the compassionate heart. A loving presence filled the room and flooded me. This is a very common characteristic of human experience. This feeling of a loving presence. Of course, capital P presence. And just parenthetically, this is not in her text, but this sense of presence is very important. It's one of the manifestations of the numinous. And the interesting thing about it to me is that we don't know through which organ the sense of presence is felt. You know there's something in the room. You experience this kind of thing at moments like births and deaths and marriages and sacred moments. And you can feel a presence in the room. It happens also in the psychotherapeutic container. But it doesn't come through the five senses. I was saying last night that the Sufis think it comes through the heart. The heart is maybe the heart chakra, is a kind of psycho-spiritual organ, as well as the five senses. Anyway, the sense of presence is another very powerful manifestation of this. A loving presence filled the room and flooded me. The oval of light shot a beam of light directly into my heart. In that moment, I saw myself with divinely compassionate eyes and was filled with a sense of forgiveness, unconditional love, and complete self-acceptance. That's another characteristic of this kind of experience. A silent voice instructed me that I didn't need to do anything. I just needed to be as I was. And then she feels that her heart is expanded, she's terrified. Then she said, after a moment of true terror, I experienced such peace that I thought I had died. In that moment of surrender, I saw the most loving moments of my life and the ones when I had constricted the impulse of love, and the moments when I had judged myself as lovable only when I lived from a standard of service. And it goes on like this. But the experience told her in so many ways that she was a loving, valuable person just for who she was, that she didn't need to be in service to other people. I felt I could have told her that a million times over 10 years and it would have had very little impression. And she certainly wouldn't have got it from a sermon on the pulpit on Sunday for 20 minutes. Because when somebody tells you something, it's not as effective as if you have this kind of direct, numinous experience. You can hear the emotional power of this. I mean, it comes straight from the head office, doesn't it? So that's where you get this emotional intensity from. And that's what has the healing effect, I think. This is a visionary experience. I did bring a few dreams, but somehow I thought that I should focus on the visionary experiences just to try to normalize them. Because they can be mistaken for psychotic experiences. They're not psychotic. These experiences are transient. They last a short time. The person then comes back to ordinary, everyday, consensual reality. There's no evidence of thought disorder or hallucinations or delusions or anything else to suggest psychosis. These are just ordinary people under a great deal of stress. That is not to say that psychotic people don't have these experiences. They do. There's no reason that the numinosum shouldn't appear to psychotic people. We have psychotic mystics and healthy mystics in the tradition. So certainly psychotic people, well, the tradition is that there's a famous story, now I can think of it, of James Joyce. Had a daughter, Lucia. Was it Lucia or Lucy? Who was schizophrenic.
Yeah.
And he took her to see Jung and said, this may be an apocryphal story, I don't know if it's true or not, but it's a teaching story. So. And he said to Jung, when I write like this, I get paid for it. When she talks like this, they want to lock her up in psychiatric hospital. What's the difference? And Jung is said to have said to him, the difference is like somebody who wants to explore the ocean, the seabed, very deep. And so they put on a diving suit, and they are carefully lowered down with an air line and a radio line and a rope so that when they want to come back, they can come back. That is different than somebody who unexpectedly falls off the boat and can't get up, is just down there unexpectedly and can't get back. So that's why people say that the psychotic drowns in the waters that the mystic swims in. They're both in the same place, but the psychotic person who's having a numinous experience is so ego-disrupted that nobody takes them very seriously, and the experience is emotionally too overwhelming. I think it's very important that these things should not be seen as psychotic experiences. Anyway, so this is a woman, this is a visionary experience of a woman who had great difficulty in relationships, had grown up feeling very unloved with no one to care for her, and she said that relationship is the most elusive and difficult aspect of my life. So here's her story. She's lying in bed, and she said, a figure appeared in my bedroom, dressed in a long, heavy, dark, brown hooded robe, and stood on my pelvis, facing me. I felt her presence and saw her clearly, but she was silent and weightless as she stood on my body. So the description is, this woman is lying in bed, and this figure in something like a monk's robe stands on her pelvis, but she doesn't feel any weight. My heart pounded, I was unable to move, but I didn't feel afraid. You can hear the archetypal quality of these figures. I sensed her deep caring and her intention to help me. She leaned forward, and with her index finger, she touched the place between my breasts, adjacent to my heart. As she did so, she drew up her finger and began to withdraw a heavy, rough cord from around my heart. I could feel the sensation of it unbinding my heart. I think that's the central image. And felt ease as the weight and heaviness of the rope was drawn away. And then the heavy cord gets finer and finer, and it turns out that the figure is using the cord to weave a tapestry. And around the experiencer is a dark puddle, which she later associated to her depression, that had always surrounded her. And the figure weaves this cloth and tapestry from this figure, from the unbound art, and uses it to cover this dark pool of fluid around her, as if giving her a way over it. She said, the experience permeated me so deeply that I was profoundly touched, shaken, and moved. So again, having all the qualities of a numinous experience, not particularly Judeo-Christian in its content. But the notion of unbinding the heart is a very powerful mythology, and it's found in many fairy tales. She was a very sophisticated person who studied mythology, and she said, I know who that was. That was Clotho, from the figure who's one of the fates in Greek mythology, was Clotho, who spun the fabric of your life. Interesting aspect of this is why the figure was weightless as it stood on her body. I was quite intrigued to hear that. I think this is an example of what's described in the spiritual traditions as an example of the subtle body, a kind of spiritual body, not the physical body. Another way of thinking about it is that this occurred in the Mundus Imaginalis. I don't know if everybody's familiar with that term. I can write it on the board. Is everyone familiar with it? Yeah. Which Corbin, the great student of Sufi mysticism, writes about a great deal. Essentially, it's the imaginal realm that the alchemists were experiencing when they were projecting intrapsychic material into the alembics in their laboratories. They were in the mundus imaginalis, the imaginal realm. Essentially, it means they were in the unconscious, I think. The point about the mundus imaginalis is that it's ontologically as real, according to Corbin. He says it's as real as the world of the senses and the intellect, and that this kind of perception has noetic and cognitive power, that's as real as the information we get from the intellect and from the five senses. So this is what Jung means, just in a different idiom, by the reality of the psyche. When you have one of these experiences, you're experiencing something, sure, it's psychological, but it's real. This is real because it has real effects. This woman felt as if her heart had been liberated by this experience. Now, sometimes I do hear of experiences which are traditional. So I thought I'd put one of these in here. This is a man who's spent his whole life involved in the Christian tradition. He says this, and you'll hear how it furthers his spirituality. He says, "I awoke with the overwhelming sense of a presence in my home. There was also an eerie silence." The silence is extremely important because, you know, in the end, you really can only experience this level in complete silence. Actually, after all the fireworks, there's often a silence which has a special numinous quality to it. Anyway, there was this eerie silence. I sat up in bed. Suddenly, a very quiet, low, rumbling tone began. A white light appeared. As the volume of the tone increased, so did the size of the light, becoming a ball that increased in circumference. The tone grew so loud I could hardly tolerate it. The light became a golden figure, and then from the center of the light I heard a voice say, "Jesus," and the ball of light moved towards me, struck me with a force that gently rocked me. Then everything went dark and quiet, and then a second tone and dot of light appeared, which grew in volume and brightness, and this time the voice said, "Come through into me," and dispersed. Then there was another period of silence and dark, and a third tone and dot of light appeared. The light grew, but when it flew into me, it was silent. Finally, the room returned to normal, leaving me awestruck. So, as I said, this man had been authentically belongs in that tradition, because that's how he experiences the sacred. But he didn't know what to make of the third experience. The first one said Jesus, the second one said Christ. The third one was completely silent. And what we realized is that he had reached a level in his development where he should experience the holy really in a non-conceptual way, not with a name, as they say in the East, beyond name and form. He'd gotten to the point where it was no longer adequate to give this a name or a form. He wanted to experience non-conceptual silence with a capital S. And that was the direction that he took after this. So that is another example of James's noetic quality of the numinous, that it gave him some very, very important information. I realize I'm flooding you with a lot of imagery. I hope it's not too overwhelming. Just an interesting experience. I once worked with a woman who was a minister, a Christian minister. And we were talking about how she got into the tradition and so on. And she said, "You know, the funniest thing is that I had an experience as a child, which I realize now, if I'd have understood it, might have turned me into a Buddhist." So I said, "What was it?" She said, when she was 5 or 6 years old, this is her story, she's 5 or 6 years old, "I was walking on a beach with my family. I had trailed behind the others and I was running to catch up with them. Suddenly a horrible thing happened. The whole world disappeared. There was a black shining surface that was really a vast immeasurable void, like a transparent lens over nothingness and a vast nothing above it. The vastness was alive, but it wasn't like a creature of any kind. I opened my mouth to scream, but nothing came out. I looked below my feet and saw that I was standing on nothing. I looked at my mother walking ahead of me with her friend. They were also walking over nothing, but they didn't realize it. I then realized that the nothing was the only thing there is." This is pure Buddhism. "I ran to the tent sobbing. My mother was angry when I tried to tell her about it and accused me of being silly. But I believed if you didn't know about the nothing, you were safe, because then the illusion of all the solidness in the world would keep you from seeing the emptiness of the vast deep void. Since I knew, I stayed in the tent. So she, here she's having an experience of shunya as a small child, of emptiness or nothingness. So sometimes these kind of numinous experiences do directly address traditional notions. But this woman wasn't raised in a Buddhist household, which is a good example of how the autonomous psyche will just express religious imagery from any kind of religious tradition. Here's another experience, a visionary experience. It begins with a dream which occurred to a woman who's a friend of mine, not a patient, but she's happy for me to describe this. She'd had a serious loss in her life, a bereavement. And in the dream, she meets the figure of death. She says, "He is tall and black-robed. His face is covered with a long veil. She tries to run away from him because she's terrified, but he follows her. She thinks of lifting the veil to look at his face, but she's too afraid." So that was the dream. So then, one day, she said, "One night, I awoke to a vision of death standing in the corner of my bedroom. I felt curiously calm, and yet driven to know this figure. I approached death." She moves into a kind of active imagination here. She says, "I approached death to throw back his veil. I was met with a blinding white light, and I could just make out the featureless face. Death was neither male nor female. Death was a shining white-skinned fetus." That's an extraordinary symbol, where death is also a fetus. "Unformed and yet formed, lacking any human particularity, but awesomely beautiful in its unborn potential. I realized that death was life, ever poised between being and non-being. Death bent towards me gently and tenderly laid its cheek against mine, a gesture like a benediction. I was flooded with an overwhelming sensation of bliss and love. My heart and brow seemed to open and teem with an exquisite energy. The experience of being touched by this figure was so profound. It had the potential to be any being, all being, or no being. The touch of its skin was amazing, teeming with life, as if I could feel its cells dividing, changing, and dancing beneath the surface. You couldn't get a better example of a true symbol, which combines opposites of life and death, new life and death, and so on." And the effect of this dream was to help her greatly with her own death anxiety, which she was suffering from terribly. And also, it somehow managed to alleviate the intensity of her grief at the loss that she had. Here's another visionary experience, if you can stand there anymore. I don't know whether I don't want to encroach on eternity, so I forgot to ask how long I was supposed to keep talking for. Do you take breaks, or should I keep going?
Yeah. Joe.